Well, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. The school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. Now, rule number one is don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut and shut up. Now, if you can learn rule one, you can win about 86% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. Now listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation and indeed police intimidation. The first judge put it this way. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" He said that in United States versus Dickerson. The second judge said, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." That comes from Belknap versus United States. And the third judge said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the far-sighted," in Marchetti versus United States. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. That's the school. Now, if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, and you can click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, here in America, we have had some real knockdown, drag-out trials, like the O.J. Simpson case, for instance. Now, that was a monumental case, took months to try it. And it came out with an unusual result. Most people would have thought that O.J. Simpson would have been found guilty. But he had hired what was known as the Dream Team, and while O.J. Simpson himself didn't do what I would recommend that he would have done had he come to my school prior to committing the crime, if indeed he committed the crime, one of the primary objectives for the defendant is to keep his mouth shut, shut up, and don't say anything. Most people don't do that. You see, from the time we're little children, we're taught to tell all. If you don't have anything to hide, then there isn't any reason why you shouldn't talk. Well, an interesting case occurred back in 1927 called Ruth Snyder and Judd Gray trial. The defendants, in this case, two of them, Ruth Snyder and Judd Gray, her lover, the crime charged was murder. The chief defense lawyers for Ruth Snyder were Edgar F. Hazleton and Dana Wallace. For Judd Gray were Samuel L. Miller and William J. Millard. The chief prosecutor was Richard E. Newcomb, Judge Townsend Scudder. And the place was Long Island City in Queens, New York. The date of the trial, April the 27th through May 9th, 1927. The verdict was guilty. The sentence was death by electrocution. And the significance of this trial was this. In a macabre way, the verdict and sentence in Ruth Snyder's case was a milestone in progress toward equality of the sexes. As the New York Times editorial summed it up after Governor Al Smith denied clemency to Ruth Snyder, it said, "Equal suffrage has now put women in a new position. If they are equal with men before the law, then they must pay the same penalties as men for transgressing it." And it was also significant that the two defendants, each of whom had confessed and tried to shift the burden of guilt to the other, were tried together, so that each was cross-examined by the other as well as by the state. It was a procedure labeled novel and dangerous by Ruth Snyder's attorney. Well, the story went like this. 9-year-old Lorraine Snyder slept late on Sunday morning, March 30th, 1927. She had gone to bed at 1:45 a.m. when she came home with her parents from a bridge party. Well, long after the usual 7:30 rising time, she was awakened by her mother, whom she found lying on the floor, her feet tied together and her wrists tied. Her mother said burglars had knocked her out and tied her up, leaving her in the next room. And after coming to, she had wriggled into Lorraine's room, and Lorraine's father was dead. Now, the police found Albert Snyder in bed, smelling of chloroform. His head was bludgeoned, and picture wire was tied around his neck. The house had been ransacked. Bureau drawers were empty. Their contents were strewn everywhere. And Ruth Snyder claimed that jewelry was missing. The house had already been robbed 3 times in the past year. Well, it just didn't look right to the police, and within 2 hours, New York City's best detectives were on the job in the Snyder's fashionable home, which 44-year-old Albert Snyder, who was an art director of Motor Boating Magazine, had bought in the Queens suburb for his 32-year-old wife. The police exhausted Ruth Snyder. They questioned her through the day and into the night. And when they told her the burglary was a fake, she indignantly replied, "What do you know? What do you mean? How can you tell?" "It doesn't look right," said a detective. "We see a lot of burglaries, and they just aren't done this way." So the police explained, and Mrs. Snyder said that she had been hit on the head by a tall man with a dark mustache and knocked out for 5 hours. But she had no bruise, and she had no lump on her head. Her wrists and ankles had been tied so loosely that they bore no marks. Neither doors nor windows had been forced, so any intruder must have been let in. The missing jewelry had been found under a mattress, and Albert Snyder's revolver had been found on his bed, broken open at the breech, but not discharged. A clumsy effort, the detective said, to make it look as if he had resisted. And then in the basement, they'd found a sash weight that was evidently the murder weapon. Now, what about Judd Gray? Well, the police did not disclose to Ruth Snyder the fact that they had found a small pin with the initials J.G. on the bedroom floor. In Ruth Snyder's address book was an entry under G for the name Judd Gray. So the investigators questioned her, "What about Judd Gray?" Well, surprised, Ruth Snyder asked, "Has he confessed?" So bluffing, the police replied that yes, he had, prompting Ruth Snyder then to confess. For a year and a half, she and Gray had been lovers. Gray, she said, wanted her husband dead. Gray had hidden in the house while they were at the bridge party, then emerged from a closet to bludgeon Albert Snyder after he had fallen asleep. Ruth admitted that she had helped to make the arrangements and ransack the house, but she said Gray had wielded the sash weight. Now, the police later found Gray in the Syracuse, New York hotel she named. When the Syracuse police arrested him, Gray first laughed at the accusation. "Ridiculous," he said. He had ample proof that he had been in Syracuse on Saturday night. But when he realized that Ruth Snyder had confessed, He then also admitted taking part in the crime, and he said, however, that he had not wanted to kill Albert Snyder, and Gray claimed that he had been coerced by his lover, who threatened to tell Gray's wife about their affair. Well, by Tuesday, the front pages boasted pictures of Gray and Ruth Snyder, along with the full text of both their confessions. But while both had confessed, each said that the other had proposed the murder. So Queens District Attorney Richard Newcomb therefore obtained their indictment together as co-conspirators. The testimony and the newspapers that eagerly reported it brought out the inherent drama of a situation that had culminated in a crime. The older, gloomy, ill-tempered, and dull husband, whose idea of fun was staying home and making artistic doodads. And then there was the lively, young, party-loving suburban housewife, dutifully sewing slipcovers for the furniture and dresses for little Lorraine. And Mr. Nice Guy Friend, a Sunday school teacher, family man, traveling salesman for a corset and bra manufacturer, and a member of the Orange, New Jersey Lodge of Elks, who took on an interest in Ruth and became her lover. The bribed postman, the coded letters, the afternoon lovers' trysts at the Waldorf Astoria, while little Lorraine was dispatched to the fun of riding up and down with the elevator operators. Well, it all added up to the inevitable need, said Prosecutor Newcomb, to get rid of Albert Snyder so that Ruth Snyder and Gray could be together. But Ruth Snyder's motive was twofold. Unbeknownst to her husband, she had recently increased his life insurance to $100,000, and she was quietly paying the premiums without his knowledge. Then, too, testimony brought out that Ruth Snyder had tried twice to asphyxiate her husband by disconnecting the gas range and had nearly succeeded in killing him with carbon monoxide by closing the garage door while the car was running his wife. And it poisoned his whiskey, so an essay that he dumped it out. Added narcotics to his medicine when he was ill, all without Albert Snyder ever suspecting her. Hang on. We'll be back with more on Trial of the Century. We're back. You're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest sponsored by Truth Radio Network. All of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Well, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three basic rules also when talking to the police or government agents, and that is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it and what not to say and who not to say it to is summed up in this maxim of law, and that is that all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these. Listen to the first judge. He said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? That comes from U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester, wouldn't I? Well, listen to the second judge. He said, you can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. That comes from Belknap versus United States. Now, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. Now, listen to the third judge. Here's what he said. The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent as well as the innocent and the farsighted. That comes from Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4100. 4967 and be sure to ask for my free General Law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is available on compact disc for home education. That's not free of charge. And if you're online, you can go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call direct 417-273-4967. All right, great American trials. Well, Ruth Snyder and Jed Gray ended up killing Ruth Snyder's husband, Albert. They were involved in a love affair, and this was one of those typical triangular love affairs, an adulterous union that ended up in, gee, we need to get rid of my husband. Well, as it turns out, the police, using standard procedures, they didn't do anything that's unusual. They do it day in and day out. Got a confession out of both Snyder and Judd. Now, going on with the story, an ironic footnote to the case was that the J.G. pin had been a keepsake of Albert Snyder's from his long-ago engagement to one Jesse Justcharge, who died before they could get married. Well, Judge Townsend Scudder said that a jury's task, amid the conflicting stories of the confessors, was to decide who had done what. Now, the judge reminded the jury that Gray testified that Ruth Snyder arranged the joint plan and jointly participated in the actual killing. Well, she testified that Gray was determined to take the life of Albert Snyder and that she endeavored to prevent him from doing so, and that she was not present at the time Gray struck the blows. And she testified that she believed she had dissuaded the defendant Gray from his alleged evil purpose. Now, her fault is that she has no heart. If the jury had much to ponder, so did the public. The tabloids were filled with colorful analysis of the characters of the defendants. The Mirror hired a well-known psychologist, one who studies the conformation of the skull. Now, this was a phrenologist, one who studies the conformation of the skull based on the belief that it is indicative of mental faculties and character, to study photos of Ruth Snyder. Well, his conclusion: her mouth was as cold, hard, and unsympathetic as a crack in a dried lemon. Now, Natasha Rambova, a reporter best known as Rudolph Valentino's widow, wrote, "There is lacking in her character the real thing, selflessness. She apparently doesn't possess it and never will. Her fault is that she has no heart." Well, in 1 hour and 40 minutes, the jury decided to accept Gray's version. He had struck the first blow with the sash weight. Albert Snyder had groaned and turned, and Ruth Snyder had finished him off with blows of her own, after which they together applied the strangling wire and added chloroform-soaked cotton for good measure. Both were found guilty. Both were sentenced to death in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison. Appeals were filed, of course, and one sought a stay of execution on the grounds that Ruth Snyder was a necessary witness in a civil suit to force three insurance companies to pay the benefits of Albert Snyder's life insurance to his daughter, Lorraine. Well, another appeal sought a writ of habeas corpus, that is, release from unlawful confinement, for Gray on the grounds that his constitutional rights had been violated by the joint trial rather than a trial of his own. Both appeals were dismissed. Ruth Snyder went to the electric chair at 11 p.m. January 12, 1928. She was the eighth woman put to death for murder in New York State as the power surged through her body. A New York Daily News photographer in the reporter's pool crossed his legs, thus triggering a forbidden concealed camera to take an unprecedented picture. When Judd Gray was executed 6 minutes later, no one took a snapshot. Now, in the analysis of this case, for our benefit, what can we learn from this? And that is that all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. In this case, both of the defendants confessed to the crime. They couldn't keep their mouths shut when they were taken in for questioning. You'll remember that Mrs. Snyder was questioned all day and late into the night. And while she was being questioned, she was giving answers. She was telling her version of the story. This is a very common procedure and a very common response. I mean, after all, you want to maintain at least the appearance that I don't have anything to hide. I'm a victim. I was robbed. Why burglars came in and did this. But you see, every time you answer a question, there's a little bit more of a story that comes out. And as the story unfolds, hour after hour, changes occur in the story. These changes are subtle, but they're always there. And that's because no one can tell the same story the same way twice. There is one exception to that. You could memorize a story. And that's another tactic that is used to show that the person is lying, and that is that the story is memorized. If a story is true, you can tell the same story over and over again for years on end, and the story will always be the same. But every time you tell it, it will be different. There will be new facts that you hadn't put in the last story, and there will be facts that you hadn't thought of or that you are thinking of now or that you thought about the last time but you can't remember this time or for whatever reason you left out. But the essential story will be the same. And that's because when events occur, when they transpire, they lodge in your subconscious mind. And if the story isn't true, then they don't lodge in your subconscious mind. They're in your conscious mind, and you have to bring them forward each and every time. Now, immediately after an event transpires, and you're asked some questions about that story, you can tell the story that you want to tell. And it will be 75% correct and 25% incorrect, and that's assuming that you want to tell the truth and that you are telling the truth, and you're doing everything in your power to communicate these facts correctly. 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. You may believe that it's true, but it isn't. That's why God has commanded us that you're not to take an oath. That's why the Scripture says, let God be true, and though every man be a liar. Now, Professor Swift, back in 1918 at Harvard University, had a test that he produced in his class where he took a class full of people, 29, and he got four students out of the class, not the one that was in session, but out of the overall class. And those four students came in and they, in 30 seconds, did a very short play. The four of them came in. One of them wielded a banana. They were yelling and screaming at one another. One of them dropped a brown paper bag on the floor containing a brick. The professor stood up throwing a torpedo. There was a loud shot, bang. There was the smell of gun smoke in the room. The one holding the banana pointed it at one of the students at the same time that the torpedo went off that the professor had thrown, that nobody had seen him throw because their minds and their eyes were all fixed upon the four actors. One of the students fell backward and said, I'm shot. he fell into the arms of one of the other students, who then picked him up and carried him out and closed the door. And when it was all over, it didn't take much over 30 seconds, certainly less than a minute. And the professor then turned to the class, who were all standing up and crowded back against the wall. They thought it was a real riot. They were surprised. They were dumbfounded by the bizarre event that they had just seen. Shocked. So the professor said, "All right, now this scene that you have just seen was made to order. Now I want all of you to sit down and write a story. I want to depose you now. I want you to tell what you just saw." And so the 29 students sat down, and for the rest of the hour, they wrote down a deposition. They wrote down a statement. They recited as truthfully as they possibly could all of the events that had transpired. Well, when they got all through, now you'd have thought that all 29 of them would write essentially the same story, but here was the bizarre part of it. 8 of the students, now remember there's 29 students, had there been 32, we would have had 25%. 8 of the students could identify one of the 4 students who came in, who were all class members, and all 29 of them met these other 4 students, the actors, at least once a day throughout the school year. But only 8 of them could identify one. They couldn't identify all 4. Nobody could identify all 4. 8 identified one. And 8 identified 2. And 8 identified 3. And 3 or 4 couldn't identify anybody. Couldn't identify anybody. And nobody was wearing a disguise, nobody was wearing a mask, and these were people that they'd seen every day. These are eyewitnesses now that identified this. Now, there were other discrepancies in their testimony, in their depositions. And the conclusion was that of all of the information that was given by all of these eyewitnesses, such as height, weight, shape, eye color, hair color, and the clothing that was being worn, would have been of absolutely no value at all. Some of them said that they had blonde hair, black hair, red hair. I mean, there was all colors of hair. There was all colors of and sizes. They were all white students. But there were all kinds of descriptions concerning their clothing. And some of the descriptions of the clothing wasn't the description of the clothing that they were wearing. And what this shows then is that eyewitness testimony is almost useless. Not quite, but almost useless. And to illustrate that, in rape cases, in 100% of rape cases, the victim must identify the rapist. And we know from DNA testing that 30% of all rape convictions are false, which corresponds very nicely with the 8 students who identified the perpetrators, and they identified the wrong people. 8 records. 8 people identified people that were not present. So stand by and we'll analyze this further when we come back. Stand by. All right, we're back for the closer. You're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. Your support of Truth Radio Network and of our advertisers and sponsors is very important to us. So for more information about Truth Radio Network programming, please go to our website. It's truthradio.com. That's truthradio.com. And Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution. Donations are not tax-deductible. And if they were tax-deductible, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth. So we rely instead upon the financial support of our listening audience instead of relying upon government for financial support. And it's you, the listening audience, that helps us pay for our satellite time, our internet audio streaming, and our overhead costs. So we want to thank you very much for that continued financial support. It's what keeps Truth Radio on the air. It comes through your donations that you make to Truth Radio here at P.O. Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444. Again, that's Truth Radio, Post Office Box 344, Napomo, N-I-P-O-M-O, California, 93444. All right, here's tonight's wise old saying. You can never be too rich or too thin. All right, Great American Trials, talking about Ruth Snyder and Judd Gray. Some lessons come out of the case, and that is, keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. Now, these two cold-blooded killers, in the case of Ruth Snyder, she had increased the insurance on her husband. These were a couple of amateur killers and obviously had never been trained in law and didn't know some of the basic police techniques, such as if you're going to claim that you got hit over the head, you need to have a lump on your head. And if you're claiming that burglars tied you up, you need to be tied up tight enough that you at least have a couple of red marks on your wrists. And then the $100,000, you know, that provided quite a little motive. The husband is dead, and then as they search the house, they find that, oh my gosh, here's the jewelry that you said was stolen hidden under a mattress. So at least take the jewelry out of the house somewhere else. And then here's the body of the man in the house, and he's got a gun, which is open, but it's not fired. Well, if it was the victim's gun, then he must have had it in his hand, and if he had it in his hand, then how come he didn't shoot the intruders? Well, that was never explained. And then comes the confessions. Snyder and Judd both confessed, and notice that they confessed based upon their belief that the other person had confessed. They didn't have their story together, did they? Now, there's another factor that comes in here. Now, let's learn a lesson. Did you notice that these two people were engaged in adultery, which is a capital felony? Yeah, that's right. Thou shalt not commit adultery. They were committing adultery. They knew it, and they wanted to cover it up. They covered it up with murder. Now, do you remember that God said that the penalty for adultery is death? And Ruth Snyder and Judd Gray both paid with their lives for the adultery that they committed. Now, I've been around for a while, and I've been observing people for many years, and I have never seen a case of adultery that ever had a good conclusion to it. Have you? Think about it. How many people do you know that, or have known of, who committed adultery? I've known of many. And I can't think of a single one of those who didn't end up divorced. That causes alimony and child support. That's a penalty for adultery. Or that it doesn't cause death. Once in a while, you'll find a husband who catches his wife with somebody else and kills them, sometimes both of them. I've seen that happen twice in my lifetime. That's a penalty that you pay. Most people would say, well, that's the penalty for getting caught. No, that's the penalty for committing adultery. So there's alimony, child support, and death. And then there's broken homes and juvenile delinquency. Those are some more penalties that we see that come from adultery. And I can't think of anything that's positive that I've ever seen come from it. On the other hand, I've seen many people who married, were faithful to one another, lived their lives, held 40, 45, 50 years of wedding anniversaries, and seemed to live their lives happily ever after, did pretty well financially, left an estate for their children, died, and are now awaiting the resurrection. They seem to have gotten on better by practicing the law that says thou shalt not commit adultery than by violating the law. I just thought I'd point that out. And we'll see that in great American trials over and over again, not just with adultery, but with the violation of numerous other laws. Now, the reason I started here with Snyder and Gray is because there's a corollary story. It's a corollary story. It's called the Vera Stretz trial. It occurred just a few years later, 1936. Same place, New York. The defendant was Vera Stretz. The crime she was charged with is murder. And the chief defense lawyer, Samuel S. Leibowitz, chief prosecutor, Miles O'Brien, Judge Cornelius Collins. The place was New York, and the date of the trial, March 20th to April the 3rd, 1936. Verdict? Not guilty. Now, the significance in this murder trial for defense counsel Samuel S. Leibowitz, the Vera Stretz case was the 116th of 139 consecutive trials in which he saved his client from death in the electric chair. Many lawyers believe that the case marked his peak as a trial lawyer before he became one of New York courtroom's most respected judges. Samuel S. Leibowitz. Yes, he won the case, but there was an important factor. A factor that is almost always missing in criminal cases, and that is Vera Stretz refused to talk to the police. She did not give them her story. She never told the police what happened. Now, she confessed to the crime. She went to the police, and she handed them the gun, and she said, I killed this guy, and then she shut up. She never said another word. Now, the Fifth Amendment guarantees you the right to remain silent. It guarantees you the right, as we see in Miranda versus Arizona, not to testify against yourself. So the policeman will give you this warning. He'll say, you have a right to an attorney, and you have a right to remain silent. And anything that you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Now, of course, these cases occurred long before Miranda. And in these cases, the police did not tell the defendants that they had a right to remain silent or that they had a right to an attorney. That's something that they had to know themselves. And Vera Stretz evidently knew that she had a right to remain silent, and she did. She was asked questions, but she didn't answer them. So that by the time she got on the witness stand to tell her story, the prosecuting attorney was hearing her story for the first time. So, unlike most criminal trials where the defendants have already been cross-examined by the police, you see, the police take your story and they put it down in your statement. Then they ask you questions concerning your story for hours on end when you become fatigued and you're so sleepy and so tired you don't know what you're saying. And then they keep noting down all of those discrepancies, and they always have witnesses present. So you're there by yourself, and the police have two or three witnesses, and they have a stenographer in there taking down all of these statements. Knowing that you can't tell the same story twice, even if you're telling the truth, they take all of these contradictory statements and then use them against you in court to impeach your testimony, thereby Many people who are actually innocent are convicted because out of their own mouths they have convicted or condemned themselves. Now, we're going to take a look at the Vera Stretz trial back in 1936, and we're going to learn a lesson from Vera. Let's get started. We'll take our break at the top of the hour, and then we'll come back and we'll analyze Vera Stretz, a 29-year-old, when she spent some of her $35,000 inheritance from her mother on a cruise aboard the Volcania in December of 1934. It was there that she met Dr. Fritz Gebhardt. Gebhardt was a German financier who was 42 years old. Chatting in German, because her German was better than his English, they became casual friends on board ship. Well, soon after returning to New York, Stretz and the doctor dated. Witty and gallant, Dr. Gebhardt seemed determined to sweep Vera Stretz right off of her feet. But the good doctor had a wife and two children back in Germany. The marriage, he said, had been one in name only for the past 10 years. He told me that he loved me, Stretz later said, and then he said that he was an unusual person. Ordinary laws applied to ordinary people, but for an unusual person there must be different standards. I was fascinated by him, Vera said. And Stretz found herself so deeply in love that in May she traveled with him to Lake George as Mrs. Gebhardt. Soon Stretz moved to Gebhardt's building, the Beekman Towers, taking an apartment two floors below his. As he traveled often, they exchanged passionate love letters. By November, Stretz regularly responded to late-night calls from Gebhardt, applying a heating pad to help him through stomach cramps as often as once a week. Well, early in November, when he returned from a European trip, he said, "I'm going away again in December, and you're going with me." Well, Stretz assumed that he had decided to end his marriage. "I'd better hurry with the wedding invitation," she said. "No," said Gebhardt. He knew now that he was not the type to get married. They would go on as lovers as they had before. Well, she told him that she would not compromise, and she wanted a home and a husband. "No one has ever left me before," he announced, "and you are not going to leave me." Well, late in the night of November the 11th, in great stomach pain, Gebhardt called her. She put on a coat over her nightgown, she slipped into shoes, and she went up the back stairs. We're going to take a break here from the top of the hour. Stand by. We'll be back in 2 minutes from the top of the hour, and then 5 minutes for any questions or tutorials, and we'll talk about a revolver and the bloodstain. Aristotle.